Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you very much for joining us here on the program again. We are recording this program on Easter Sunday. Well, if you have been listening to the program for any length of time, you know where we were last year on Easter Sunday. We were sitting in the home of Swami Vidyadishananda, and guess what? We're back again to hear some wonderful words and information from Swami Vidyadishananda, who is going to talk to us on a wide variety of subjects. And what we try to do on this program, as you've heard many times, is share different points of view and perspectives. We come your way every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We're streaming live on the internet at richarddugan.com, and we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, and you can go to the radio show's page and listen to any past programs. I want to welcome our guest, and as I did the last time, also thank you for allowing us to come into your home. This is, I know, a time for you of a quiet time, a time for reflection and devotion for you for about four or five months, if I'm not mistaken. And so we kind of have been graciously given an opportunity to talk with you, and I thank you very much for that.
No, I welcome you on the Easter Sunday, and it's just like last year, I was waiting for the day. I knew that I will be coming out of my reclusive time around this time, and my programs begin from April 17th, so this is just good timing.
You travel quite a bit as well, and obviously back and forth to India, is that correct?
Yes, I do have to go to India, especially to the mountains, lower Himalaya mountains for Sanskrit research, and higher Himalaya mountains to do some austere practices, meditations with some of my other monks and friends from monastic lineages. Mm-hmm. So that will be coming up in October, November, and beginning part of December. Just when it gets very cold, I'll come down.
which is just about right. Yeah. I wanted to start our conversation talking about, I mean, as we shared before we started, I have several different directions that we could go. I want to start with the root, at least my understanding is the root of language, and that being Sanskrit. Now, you have a school in England where you teach the students to read and write.
Actually, no, I don't teach directly. I help with many institutions to make their Sanskrit education curriculum. The one in London is not connected with me. They have a school which is where they require learning Sanskrit for more than one reason. And why we try to keep the learning of Sanskrit active and alive is that it has a great result in terms of whole brain learning. So we have gone away from the ancient tradition, and because of the way we are driven now in the modern education curriculum, it is becoming very much a left brain learning, as we say. Mm-hmm. Sanskrit begins with learning through the right brain and then integrates the left brain. And so we call it a whole brain learning. And there are various ways to do that. And some of the traditions in India which are still alive have shown great results due to that approach in terms of memory, in terms of even analytical abilities. So the whole brain learning does not compromise the analytical and mathematical ability. In fact, they only enhance. But it allows the students of Sanskrit and its related subjects to have very good memory. And so we have great examples of that tradition even in India. And I am also I did do both the modern Western study as I grew up in India, and as well as the traditional Vedic curriculum for Sanskrit. So I have seen the results myself, how it tallies. And so I'm myself a very big proponent of using the whole so-called whole brain learning method.
Can you give us a little background on Sanskrit? What is the alphabet of Sanskrit? And I don't necessarily mean every letter, but is there a name for the letters, the characters that
right.
are used?
Right, we say chatushashtihi varnaha. There are 64 sounds. And there are two ways to use Sanskrit. Part that is almost lost from the Indic tradition is the which we call as padapatha, meaning the sounds which are taken as ideas through art forms. That is more found and preserved, that technique of Sanskrit is more found and preserved in the Southeast Asian languages like Chinese, Japanese, Korean, so on and so forth. But the part that is very much prevalent in India and very much still thriving is the actual letter form for partitions of sound. And in that, we do not use calligraphic forms, but we actually use letters just like in other languages. And that's where the Indo-European language tree comes in. So Sanskrit being one of the root languages and a mother language of many languages, it preserves through 64 partitions of sound, out of which 52 are heavily used, out of which 50 are primarily used. And to learn the language fully in terms of intonations and sound for singing and recitation, sublime recitation, one needs to know all the variations of those 64 sounds. And so that is, but the part that is, which I said about calligraphy, calligraphic form for ideas using sound constructs are rarely used. It is used in some of the northeastern parts, in some tribes, and in Himalaya, but it is mostly not available right now in India. And out of those 64 sounds, the way they work is that it has a very unique structure, which is known as Dhatu Rupa, root sound. And there are roughly 2,500 roots. And they're operated upon by some operators, which are basically sounds in nature. And when you operate, you create a word factory. And that's how the words are generated. Out of those 2,500 dhatu, the actual roots are, there are about 1,400 which are used outside of India. So majority of Sanskrit's root sounds are actually available in the Indo-European tree outside of India. About 800 to 1,100 are used, 800 more prevalent, and around 300 to 400 less prevalent in tribal areas, in some remote areas of India and some remote villages of India. So this is the way, so the word factory is very unique method of creating words in Sanskrit. And the name is very interesting. Samskruta Bhasha, meaning Sanskrit language, or Samskrutam actually means that which is already perfected, hinting that it is given to us from some subtle source, from some higher source, and that it is very difficult to Sanskritic. It is very difficult to find faults with it because it's such a unique structure. So being the name meaning that it is already perfected, it has some fantastic gifts to us when we use it, especially with whole brain learning, and which I feel in my own research, a higher performance of the human nervous system when we study Sanskrit.
So if I'm understanding on a very primitive level from my standpoint, it's similar to some of the other ancient languages. When I think of, for example, the language of Hebrew, each character has a legend to it, if you will, numerical, tonal, meaning, you know, and so forth. So each letter in Sanskrit likewise has those same elements and then some. Then when you put each one of those characters together to form words, a whole new meaning, you start putting those words together to form sentences, etc. So when we translate from Sanskrit into any other language, is there a lot lost because you can't carry the legend, if you will, from each of the characters into the other language in that fashion?
Pretty much correct. Sanskrit is a very compact language. So because each word has a unique place in the sentence, and you can swap them and there is no subject or object order necessary. It's only because of style we need to keep some.
Mm-hmm.
But you can swap them because the position, each word is uniquely conveying a meaning and it does not affect in what order they come. But being such a compact language, when we translate, it's going to be very difficult to convey the same meaning for exact same reasons what you just said.
And if you've just joined us, I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Swami Vidyadishananda, and we are in his home on an Easter Sunday evening. And again, I thank you for allowing us to come in and set up all our equipment and in one sense sort of intrude on your private time. And again, we thank you for that. As we continue, I will be coming back in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story, and we'll be right back.
Keeping all that fear inside. I understand how trouble haunts you. It haunts me too. Yes, and I do know how you feel. Oh, come on, walk with me, talk with me.
And this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. We come your way every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. Stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com, and the programs are archived at richarddugan.com on the radio shows page. This program is being recorded on Easter Sunday evening, 2010, and we're actually pretty excited because we're having an opportunity to learn some things we didn't know. We were talking before the break about the Sanskrit language. The phrase that I hear quite often when I hear of individuals, and there don't seem to be a lot, and maybe it's just because I haven't run into many of them, who are in higher education and they are actually studying Sanskrit, and there will be those who will criticize them for studying a quote unquote dead language. How dead is Sanskrit?
In India, current languages which are spoken have evolved out of Sanskrit due to various reasons, one of them being simplification. So Sanskrit does demand a lot of time commitment to have it fully grasped and used both as a written and a spoken language. So I would say 10 to 12 years of commitment is needed to a language, which is a tall order. And so Sanskrit is only alive as a spoken language in some pockets in India, mostly in countryside, not in cities. And other than that, it is alive in monasteries with monks, and it is alive in some specific schools known as traditional Vedic schools, where the Vedic priests are getting trained in specific intonations of how to use Sanskrit literature as mantra and as resonant recitations for doing some rituals. So outside of specific universities, monasteries, schools, which are scattered all over India, and in some pockets of villages, there is hardly any mainstream use of Sanskrit. Especially given the economy and the needs to support, so there is really not much job prospects for a great Sanskrit scholar other than relying on the power of Sanskrit itself, because they will become precious because there are very few who are around at that level.
Mm-hmm.
Sanskrit is being taught in school and universities, but it is, I would not say it is a dead language, but it is thriving more as a ceremonial language for purposes of doing ceremonies, but it is not being used as a commonly spoken language, which is unfortunate because, as I said, the two unique gifts Sanskrit gives to us is one is that extraordinary memory. There are traditions known as Shatavadhani, Ashtavadhani, meaning they will come and demonstrate their memory powers due to the traditional training in Sanskrit language. And there are also the chanters who do sublime recitation for hours and sometimes even days, sitting in one seat, an asana, and without break and without having the difficulty of not having to memorize, because they have memorized virtually thousands and thousands of verses. So both the chanters and the avadhanis, the specialized performers who show how what can be attained through memory, is a product of what is known as the Shruti tradition. Shruti means intent listening. And so we say that in Sanskrit tradition, we use hearing rather than visual. Mm-hmm. So the hearing tradition requires one to attentively listen and orate back. So you have oration method, which you hear yourself again. And then so you basically repeat after the teacher and you learn faster and so-called deeper because of, you know, how you activate the memory cells. And therefore the tradition requires that, even though we should not call it rote learning, it does have a hearing component, which is based on going to schools where you listen to the teacher who is giving a particular intonated verse in a particular way. And so it takes 10 to 12 years before the language is mastered, and that is one of the reasons why it has fallen out of mainstream use. But I would say that it is still thriving in some pockets.
I spent 10 to 12 years in traditional American school, and I still have trouble with the English language. So, but you're talking, and there was not maybe a whole lot of dedication there either, but that's really what you're speaking to, is if someone wants to study the language, there has to be that level of dedication of that 10 to 12 years.
Absolutely, yes. Even to learn Sanskrit grammar, which is not necessary for the beginning stages of learning the language, one can study the linguistics and the spoken aspect of the language and get a feel for it like any other language. But grammar would be needed for higher studies, and that's an additional time. But to grasp the language and speak it, or decipher it from a written text, and which includes basic grammar, it will need a dedicated time of 10 to 12 years. In other words, you need to start early, and when you graduate out of school, you must have had a very thorough daily practice. Even we have difficulty keeping up with it. It takes 4 to 5 hours a day if you want to keep it at a level where you can speak it whenever you want. Mm-hmm. So it does demand the structured time commitment.
Now, you said that there are pockets around the world, in India specifically, and other parts of the world where the language is not only just taught, but spoken, correct?
Yes.
And so, who does the language belong to? Meaning, what's the lineage, what people, heritage, does Sanskrit come through or from? I know you mentioned earlier that from a higher place, but it came from a higher place down to who?
Yeah. It is known as a Daiva Bhasha. It is known as, which is literally translates as language of the gods. So there are, the language says that it is spoken by the subtle beings whom the people on the earth cannot yet see. So, but some of the most ancient literature of Sanskrit are actually in the Veda. And so it is called collectively as a Vedic heritage. Rig Veda is considered one of the oldest written, not only spoken, but also written text. Thousands of years, it's actually, we call it Vedic antiquity because we don't have a timeline. My monastic heritage dates back to more than 3100 BCE. It was formalized in 500 BCE. And as far as our records go, it's much older than, so we do not have exact timeline. But there are pockets in Europe which is spoken. As with any other tradition, which are tradition of very subtle and higher learning in meditation and Sanskrit, there is evidence both from linguistic point of view and from the lineage point of view that it originated in the Himalayan valleys. Now, the first people who inhabited in the Himalayan valleys and then spread around, spread the use of Sanskrit, and still, even now, it is practiced in a very pure form in some pockets in the lower Himalayas and some areas in India. But grammarian-wise, very good experts of Sanskrit are available in Russia, Germany, and some of the European countries. The Baltic states used to have a very good Sanskrit tradition. Some of the old tablets found in other countries, for example, even in Finland, they are known to be of Sanskritic origin. Some of the libraries in Northern Europe have very good Sanskrit collection. So we say that the heritage is very old, but as with mysticism and esoteric practices of meditation and the great grammarians and writers of Sanskrit, it looks like it is of origin of within in these Himalayan valleys, but thousands of years we cannot really go back and exactly quote a date.
Okay. And obviously, we don't have 10 to 12 years on this program to continue to elucidate on the Sanskrit language, but it's something that people can certainly look into. But it also behooves me to say, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's not going to do someone any good to go out and try to find a Sanskrit to English translation dictionary to try to learn to speak the Sanskrit language, because it doesn't work that way.
That's right. That would be very, very difficult to do. The language is structured in a way that it demands the Shruti tradition, intent listening. You need to, there are limits. If you remove the teacher, there are limits to which how far you can go. But best would be to learn the resonant and melody aspect of the language, the beautiful aspects of the language from a teacher directly, and definitely not through a dictionary. There are very good learning methods, and we call them tricks to learn and elucidate, and it is best learned directly from a teacher, just like in a university setup. We call it in India, interestingly, a very nice word called Gurukulam. Gurukulam meaning studying with a lineage of masters and staying near the masters, near the teacher, and in a special school or in a special setup where you have less distraction. And Gurukulam translates into Latin as a curriculum, which in English becomes curriculum. So that's how close the sounds are.
I'd like to shift our discussion a little bit into another area, because there are times in my lifetime, I have seen a number of people come and go, heads of churches and other religious groups and organizations and belief systems, who have this idea, this structure, if you will, whether it's in a book or, you know, they just expound on it, and people follow them. Now, you have devotees who, correct me if I'm using the wrong word here, who follow you, but you are also a devotee of others or an other. Why is that important to find a master, a guru, someone who can lead you, rather than just trusting in, say, one's own heart and listening to that still small voice?
Yeah, there is the inner voice, which has to be recognized and listened to. That is true. In the Indic tradition and Sanskritic philosophy, we use the term lineage very much. And the lineage term is not used to actually explain familial lineage, but the lineage term is heavily used to actually track the lineage of masters, spiritual masters. And because although every human being is potentially divine, to fully unravel the divinity and show and lead the way in a structured, methodical way. There are very good meditation methods, prayer methods, and a study method. We say swadhyaya, self-study and study of scriptures, and which can be only shown by somebody who has been revealed. And so there is the tradition of learning and studying with a spiritual teacher who need not be just a mystic, but is usually also a scholar. And the scholarship comes from the Sanskrit background. And they have studied Sanskrit philosophies and have a lot of clarity in terms of how they should guide the seeker away from the distractions of the world and anchor into a path which would be very self-fulfilling. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are devotees, but we say the marker for a true teacher is that how they're connected with the lineage. The lineages are more important. Some of the lineages are unbroken for centuries. In other words, we have a clear tracking record of who the teachers have been in that lineage. And that shows a continuity. And that also shows the seeker that the esoteric meditation practices or the teaching guidelines or the books that have been referred to are all preserved in one continuous manner. And in other words, the authenticity of the knowledge base is more easily verifiable. And that's why seeking is related to a lineage of masters in the Indic tradition. It's a very powerful method. Less things can go wrong. You verify the lineage, you see the teachers in the lineage, you see their works, and see how they have interpreted the messages, and then you have more verifiable method of whether the teacher is going to be able to deliver or not. And so there is this way of following a lineage and a lineage of teachers and masters rather than just some self-proclaimed teacher who says, I am incarnation so and so, I can teach it all. So these are markers to cross-check the validity of authenticity of the knowledge base. Mm-hmm. And so that's why lineage in the Indic tradition is very, very important. Very important.
And there's a difference between that and one of the things that was rolling around in my head was the aspect of, say, the Catholic Church saying that, well, Peter was the first pope. And they can go back and there's Peter in the Bible and so forth. And yet people don't actually follow this office, if you will, the papal office. It's just the head of the organized religion, if you will, which is different from what you're talking about in terms of somebody who is seeking a master, a guru, a teacher, someone to guide them through, as you say, away from the destructive aspects of life to some of the higher levels.
Right. One important distinction is that, which is hidden in your question, which I want to throw light, is that the tradition of authentic spirituality is not so institutionalized in the Indic tradition, especially from the traditions I come from, the Himalayan masters tradition and very esoteric practices. They are individual achievement based and somewhat informal. And there is, because there is a shunning away from condition of money with spiritual teaching. So the institutionalized aspects of an organized movement are not there in the lineage-based traditions, which are, of course, some degree of organization is needed. Otherwise, who will host the teacher, which is more of a modern twist. But in India, they are less institutionalized to keep it more accessible so that one can directly learn from a master who has been revealed the higher truths. So that's, I think, a good aspect of the access to true teachings rather than an institutionalized twist. So in that sense, we say you become a disciple of a lineage rather than disciple of an organization, because an entity which is abstract cannot really teach you. who teaches is actually who has been revealed the higher truth, who has experienced it and can guide you from experience if you are having difficulty in the practices. So therefore, the approach is more personalized and less institutionalized. And that is why lineage becomes more important, because how would you verify that the teacher comes from a noble, verifiable, highly exalted tradition of revealed masters? So that's why lineage becomes very important in this context.
And as we've shared in the previous program, your lineage is similar to that of Paramahansa Yogananda, and I use the analogy that you're different branches but on the same tree.
Yes, I studied, it's actually dependent on the philosophy, Sanskrit philosophy line you study. I studied four independent philosophies, yoga, Sankhya, Vedanta, and Tantra. I have, so therefore I have multiple lineage affiliations. For Kriya Yoga, which is part of the yoga philosophy, Yoganandaji is part of my lineage and a group of masters. In fact, you are sitting in front of an altar which has the Kriya Yoga lineage. For Sankhya philosophy, I have a slightly different lineage. My Sanskrit language course, and those who taught me linguistics and grammar, those teachers of a different lineage. And then I was also taught esoteric aspects of higher philosophies in Tantra, which includes meditation on the deities, the cosmic figures, and then also on Vedanta. Vedanta philosophy, I studied Upanishad, the Vedantic literature from a series of masters, including my own monastic master. So I do initiations into meditation in four different philosophies, but three of them I'm offering in general once or twice a year. So they have different lineages, and these lineages are very well known in India and have lot of depth in terms of mastering their Sanskrit philosophical heritage.
And you actually raised an interesting point in terms of Sanskrit as you spoke there, and sort of going back to that subject, that when you use Sanskrit, the language, it's not to say hello or order a hamburger. It's used for higher purposes, if you will. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, absolutely. It can be used as a regular spoken language, but we study Sanskrit to meditate, reflect, and learn philosophy, spiritual philosophy. So spiritual philosophy, by its very nature, is universal and non-sectarian. So the monastic teachings and the lineages of monks in various pockets and monasteries in India study Sanskrit to master and grasp spiritual philosophy of the ancient world.
I just wanted to touch on that. It just kind of came to mind as we are sitting here talking with Swami Vidyadishananda. And this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. And we're sitting in the monastic home, if you will, of Swami Vidyadishananda, who, am I correct? You are, if you will, the founder of the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship.
You can say that I'm the founding president, but actually it was the devotees and the lovers of the Sanskrit Vedic tradition who kind of requested me to put a foot here. So we got approved in July 2006 by the authorities to fully function as a nonprofit. And so I would say the nonprofit hosts me rather than me running the nonprofit. So that's how it is.
And you are not one who has gone out and written a book and people have read it and, hey, let's follow this guy. You are teaching from the ancient teachings,
right,
the ancient wisdoms.
A very important point. Our vows as monks include a vow to present the ancient Sanskrit philosophy as accurately as possible without distortion. So I do not make my own meditation techniques, and I do not teach whatever I think is good for humanity. I am here as an instrument to precipitate, preserve, and disseminate the ancient wisdom and see in my own eyes how those wisdom can be applied to modern society.
Do you ever find people who come to you and say they want to be a devotee? Even you sense that they're not really serious. I mean, they're looking for something, but it isn't a devotee. It isn't learning the lineage. It's not learning the ancient traditions. It's just wanting to belong.
Yes, many are coming to find ways to resolve their problems in life and support their inkling and yearning. We do guide them. We have ways, and we do have reading lists for those who want to understand what their inner voice is projecting onto them and how they can improve their lifestyle and lead a more meditative lifestyle, if you want to say. And there are beginners, and we do have, but we also have many requests for standard meditation practice with additional guidelines of diet and physical fitness. And I also come from a yoga vinyasa krama tradition. So the yoga vinyasa krama is movement and transitions, just like a ballet, with the breath. And so a lot of breath work in yoga. So I also teach those aspects of yoga, not just the higher end yoga philosophy. As far as writing a book, when we write books based on the ancient spiritual philosophy. We do not write books as a matter of just personal experience. And so I am in the process of writing a couple of books, but they will be only based on the Sanskrit philosophy.
Mm. It seems to me that to choose a monastic life, whether it be you who has chosen this life or someone who's been living in the, I mean, I'm a city boy. I was born and raised in Phoenix, and I moved out here to the Central Coast, and that was a big change for me. But when someone chooses that, that has to come from really deep inside. Again, it's almost the same kind of level of commitment as if you were going to study Sanskrit for 10 to 12 years.
Yes, it was a big decision for me to give up the studying in the lower Himalaya and the austerities in the higher Himalaya, which was also very attractive and enchanting, even though winters in Himalaya are very, very harsh and difficult. And that's when we come down a little bit to the plains to study Sanskrit in the winter, because it's almost you can't really do anything other than sitting inside completely sealed chambers, caves and hutments. Yeah, it was a big decision for me to come to the West, but I do feel cushioned and supported by higher forces in preserving and anchoring a legacy of the very esoteric components of our lineages in the West. And I hope to create publications which are very authentic representations of that heritage, as leaving a mark of service. So I consider my role as a public service, and I've taken the decision to stay in the West as one of my principal anchors and help create the legacy with the nonprofit, preserve some of the very esoteric components and knowledge base of spiritual philosophy of the very ancient tradition for the sake of future generations. And so that's the aspect. But one important completion to the previous question is that the meditation techniques we are teaching are not meant for monks. They are meant for seekers wherever they are in the world in their modern lifestyle. So we believe that the spiritual philosophy of the Sanskrit literature is so complete that its tenets are applicable wherever you are. And so these are practices for householders. So I'm not going to come here and try to create an atmosphere where everybody should be asked to become monks. Mm-hmm. So we give meditation techniques to householders who are seeking to try the validity of precise methods and steps of meditation techniques, which were told so many thousand years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very important distinction, that even though it is coming through a monk, I am not trying to say that monk is the only dedicated pathway. I'm saying that, okay, wherever you are, you can try to learn these meditation techniques and seek joy.
And someone listening might say, well, wow, Swami Vidyadishananda's got a cushy job. I mean, but you have your own challenges in your life.
Yes, I actually live a very, very, very austere life. And partly because we have a saying in our tradition that if you take happiness from the external world, then you will suffer the consequences by remembering the worldliness. So remembrance of worldliness is connected how much happiness you seek from the external world. So austere practices is a way to live in the world, but yet, just like a lotus leaf doesn't get wet, to not get wet from the world. So my role is to lead an austere life and focus on the higher aspects of meditation and writing and philosophy, and first be an example, live the example, and then speak from the Sanskrit literature.
Which brings to mind the biblical phrase, be in the world but not of it. But you're also telling us that through this life that you have chosen, you are also not allowing yourself to be attached to all of the various elements that, in a sense, that the rest of us, because we haven't chosen that life, are attaching to, loved ones and animals and possessions, and the list goes on.
Yeah, we are so much into the monastic way that we don't even think of what we are missing, because we don't feel that we are missing, mm-hmm. in a way. So even though a monk is dispassionate about the world, but that dispassion is actually the source of compassion also. So the universality and ability to love all and adore without lusting comes from the monastic ethos, and which is rooted in dispassion. So dispassion is the foundation. We say in Sanskrit, vairagya. It's the foundational core behind the practice. So dispassion causes more intense austere practices, which allow us to be more dispassionate, which in turn cultivates compassion for the world. So I believe from my own experience that the renunciation or the spirit of renunciation has increased the dispassion in me to the extent that I am able to be compassionate to everybody equally.
I like that. I think that in these times in which we live, those of us who are still doing the day-to-day, I'll call it the worldly life, if you will, or the non-monastic life, we're getting knocked around because we're getting attached to the various events around us, and we hear what's going on in the news, and it bombards us. You obviously are aware that these things are happening because they've been happening to humanity as long as we've been here. But because of your life and your lifestyle, you aren't being barraged by it. Yes, you're aware of it, and you're able to then cultivate the higher energies, if you will, and also teach that to others to help to maybe keep the world a little calmer, in a manner of speaking.
Yes, absolutely. I consider that those who are meditating very deeply in caves have a lot to do with the peaceful vibration all around us. Even though they are not actively participating in serving the world, they are doing great service from their silent meditation. So you have put together very well what is the spirit of renunciation. And in our tradition, we say that we have to even renounce the renunciation itself. In other words, you should not be overjoyous about your renunciation, because if then you are taking advantage of the spirit of renunciation. So it should naturally happen, that nothing should cling to you, and you focus on the good work.
Yeah.
And the good work is compassionate service.
I remember hearing the phrase from someone who said that if all of those around the world who were either in the monastic life or spinning prayer wheels or on their knees praying or whatever the spiritual life they've chosen, if they all stopped it, the earth would just spin out of control. It's like you said, it's these people that are sort of holding it together for us. And the more of us that can join in, maybe we can sort of turn that corner, because a lot of people are looking at calamity around the corner.
Yeah, I'm honestly, I haven't worried at all about the calamity, because there are many things without, there are many events completely beyond control of human factor. And I think positive spirit and positive thinking is immensely more powerful. And so if we ruminate on and negative ideas and negative thoughts, then not only we are creating an environment of fear, but it is also very difficult on our own health. So we lose the moment by worrying about the future. And so it is better to not ruminate about any event, not just the hint you're making about a certain year, but any event through a worry factor. And so I try to remain positive all the time, even though I may be constructively criticizing a situation that it did not fructify because of these mistakes, but it is more to correct the mistakes rather than get stuck on the negative aspect of it.
And we're going to take a short break. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan with Swami Vididhishananda here on this program. We encourage you to go to richarddugan.com and listen live every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. We'll be right back.
If we leave here today, we could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road, see how ocean road, all the countries in our bones, all the trouble that you know empties out as you go.
This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Swami Vididhishananda as we wrap up the last couple of minutes in our program. Again, thank you so much for sharing your time. And I have a funny feeling that we may be doing this on a regular basis every Easter Sunday. And I actually would look forward to that if we were to sort of make that a regular, an annual event.
Yes, if I'm in town, I do not. Usually my reclusive period is the winter. And if I'm in town at that time, I would be very happy to be participating.
That would be great. Well, again, I thank you so much for sharing your home and your time with us, and the wonderful, I call it information, insight and inspiration. And I'm hoping that our listeners can certainly take something away with that. And they'll be able to listen to this program again on the website, because we'll archive it as well. So I thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you very much for...
I'm Richard Dugan, and this has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We certainly hope that you will check out the website, as well as check out richarddugan.com. This program, it's archived up on the website, and I think you're going to really enjoy listening to it again. Until next Saturday at the same time, love to all.